Morning. Thank you, Rod. Sometimes when I come out here, it does feel like the meditation is just, we might just want to end it there, you know. But I'm here anyway, so I'll say something. First of all, though, before I get into some of this, congratulations on becoming famous. Interesting that it happened between the 2 weeks that I was here. Just saying. I hope it doesn't go to your head. Start staying out all night and partying with the wrong crowd. I've seen it happen. I worry about you, but you seem like a pretty level-headed crowd, so hopefully you'll wear it well. But anyway, if you become an inspiration for even more groups like this across the country, great. And maybe especially to those of you who are part of the founding of C3, special congratulations for the fruit of your labors. Okay. And now, AI and immigration. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of the hot button issues in ethics. Again, as we look forward to election season, not a lot of people talking about artificial intelligence, but you're going to hear anything and everything about the border, right? You turn on the television, you can't miss those ads. But you don't have to take my word for it. Number one existential threat to all humankind. If I hadn't already primed you, you might say climate change, you might say pandemics, you might say nuclear war, you might say, you know, what happened to U of M yesterday? I mean, I don't know. There are any number of things you might say. Number one existential threat to humankind is artificial intelligence. According to over 1,700 existential threat risk experts, who are scholars, professors, think tank types, who spend their whole lives looking at this kinds of thing. Most popular course at the University of Chicago last year was a course called Are We Doomed? Packed them in, and the answer was probably, and not so much because of all the other, you know, usual suspects, artificial intelligence. So normally when you've got an ethical dilemma or topic in front of you, you want to define it, you want to understand it as best you can. Tough in this case because if you know anything about artificial intelligence, you know it's already broken into a number of subcategories, some more beneficial, some more dangerous than others. So let me just give you a couple working definitions that I'll have in mind for this. Narrow or weak artificial intelligence, this sort of machine learning that we hear so much about, aggregate tremendous amounts of data, recognize patterns, do things like write memos for us, and college papers to some degree, let me say. Nothing you'd want to actually write home about unless you were using your own words. This notion that it can do an awful lot of tasks that humans can do at sort of basic levels, and a lot of benefits to that. I mean, we're seeing it already, the ability to look at x-rays and find patterns and see things that are not necessarily always obvious to oncologists or radiologists or others. Lots of benefits in terms of aggregated data. On that level, that's going to continue. We're going to have to learn to live with that in one way or the other. ChatGPT 3 especially, 4 sort of also good examples of this narrow or weak artificial intelligence. The existential threat is what's called artificial general intelligence, sometimes linked to yet another subcategory called artificial super intelligence. That'll be the kind of intelligence that'll come out of these black box engineering experiments that lead to wherever the AI is housed, the takeover of the internet, the takeover of financial markets, the takeover of all kinds of defense platforms, et cetera, put us at existential risk because it will do a handful of things. One of the things, most interestingly, will be to, not unlike the Matrix at all, if you remember that great series of films, create, this is in the words of one of the leading developers of artificial general intelligence, layers upon layers of illusions, narrative illusions, because it's so much smarter than we are, that we will buy into. We'll think, well, no, I'll never fall for that. Yes, we will. It will create multiple versions of reality, not necessarily to intentionally have us become extinct, to kill us. The analogy that a lot of the engineers use and commentators is by seeking its own goals, it will, much in the same way that we wipe out insect populations or other animals or devastate forests, not purposefully, but because we're seeking goals that fulfill some of our needs, super intelligent or general AI will also just essentially push us out of the way as it seeks more and more of its own goals. The other thing it'll do is consume tremendous amounts of energy in ways that'll make less energy available to the rest of us. So the existential threat part of artificial general intelligence is, from my reading anyway, if it happens, its attempt to essentially supersede us is a foregone conclusion. The engineers are so matter of fact when they talk about this, it's startling to somebody like me who's not an engineer. They say, oh yeah, I have no doubt that it will in fact run its course. It will supersede us. It will look to achieve its own goals. It will not pay any attention to us. We will not be able to control it. They're absolutely matter of fact about that. And so the antidote is not pulling the plug. There's no plug to be pulled. It'll generate its own energy. The antidote is what they call AI alignment. And as somebody who has studied ethics for a long time, this is the one that really puts me on my heels. You say, well, what we'll do, the engineers, is we'll build in values, human values, things that we care about, to the AI so that when the AI goes off on itself, supersedes our intelligence, does whatever it's going to do, it still will reference the values that we as humans hold. I thought to myself, this morning was a good example, Rod referenced it. Have you ever been in a room of more than like three people where there's one universal value that you're all holding that's necessarily going to sway artificial intelligence? And if it's that smart, one of the things it's going to be even better at than us is rationalizing its behavior. So I have very little faith in that happening. I'm, of course, worried about the existential threat from an ethics point of view, but I'm 66 almost, so, you know, what the hell. No, here's where I'm in some cases less worried about it than I am the other part of the weak AI that I'll tell you about in a second. And that is the artificial general intelligence, the superintelligence, it's going to happen in 4 years, it's going to happen by 2060, or it's never going to happen. So, and the engineering community, the smartest people in the world who are working on this stuff, that's where they are. About a third of them, 4 to 5 years, about a third of them, 2060, and a third of them, it's just never going to happen. I can't see a path to it. So we worry about it, but we don't worry about it as much as the following. So imagine this. You are working in a company or you're at a school, and somebody from one of these narrow AI companies who already has the ability to do this comes in and says, boy, have we got a device for you. You just took it up to the computer or set it on somebody's desk. You can tell from this, you can do voice modulation, you can do all kinds of physiological measurements. Said, we gather all that stuff on a weekly basis, we feed it into this huge aggregated data collecting and analysis program that we've got back at the lab, and we can let your people know, worker or student, if this really is the right fit for them and how well they're doing. So you as a manager get a printout every week. They're like a 7.2 on a 10-point scale in terms of enthusiasm dealing with customers, you know? Or you're on like a 6.9, you know, on a 10-point scale in terms of your ability to attend to the lecture. All this very granulated data that will be spit out in a summary in which managers don't then use any of their own accumulated or practical wisdom. They refer to this sort of outsourced data program, weak AI, that tells you exactly what the mental, emotional, physical state of your employee or student is, and you can make a decision, and you're supposed to make a decision week to week based on that, okay? And it's couched in the language of course, this will help that person, say, you know? You need a little professional coaching, which of course we'll outsource as well, to be a little bit more enthusiastic or a little more responsive or attentive, and you know, then the AI will come up with the medication that you're supposed to be using to help you do that. There's a whole sort of number of things fall from this as a slippery slope argument. So that's the one I put in front of my MBA students. I said, look, you know, it's promising a great deal of efficiency. It's going to take a lot of work off your plate, and it's going to give you scientific background to say this person should be promoted, this person should be fired, this person should be reprimanded, this person should be coached, whatever it might be. Do you want it? Show of hands, MBA students, how many do you think want it? Oh, come on. Well, they're not where you are, but... But it's closer. Right now it's trending about 65-35 in favor of rejecting it. But the 30, every year to year, the 35, it goes from 25 to 30 to 35. I don't think it's going to be long before that number tips into the majority. And right now, the ethical arguments against it are privacy. It's an invasion of privacy. I wouldn't want it, you know. It seems, even though I have a hard time articulating it, it seems degrading or somehow dehumanizing to this person to be subject to this black box on their desk. And are we being as transparent as we could be? Do I really know? Do they really know? You know exactly how this stuff is being collected, interpreted, and analyzed. And that's one of my favorite things about favorite in the sense of I'm astounded by listening to the engineers and reading the engineers talk about, especially the experiments in AGI, but even AI. And you've heard reference to this with, you know, any number of the sort of unintended outcomes. And so you ask these really, really smart people. He said, so you put in, right, you know all the inputs. Yeah, we basically know all the inputs. He said, so you'd have some sense of what you might be able to predict as the outcome. No, we have no idea. In fact, it does all kinds of things, including making up its own language in terms of talking to one another, that we can't follow, that we don't know. They still cannot explain to a large degree how and why they get the results that they get, which is why so many people, not just like, you know, worried, anxious ethics professors, but actually engineers and business people and the rest, there is a growing call for a pause on any further research into artificial general intelligence. And this is all the way from whatever you think of him. I always hesitate to invoke this guy, but from Elon Musk all the way down to folks who are genuinely concerned that black box is going to, if not kill us, it's going to severely change the quality of our lives. There are about 70 labs across the world right now. It represents close to $1 trillion already in terms of investment and possible profit margins, the development of AGI, about 40 countries. And let me take one guess whether those folks want this stuff to be paused or not. They don't, but we've done it before, right? Cloning. There are a couple of states, in more than a couple of states, that allow cloning for research purposes in the United States. But across the board in the states, we do not allow human cloning. And the bioethicists especially got together and said, whoa, this is just the Pandora's box. You have no idea what's going to happen. The general consensus is, or I should say this, the consensus we're moving towards is the same thing is true of AGI, and we ought to be putting some pressure on folks to at least take a pause. Say, look, a lot of the stuff is promising. A lot of the stuff looks good. The AGI is scary. We don't know if it's possible or not. Let's pause until we kind of catch up in terms of our thinking about it, okay? So that's the artificial intelligence piece. What I didn't say about that is one of the concerns people have about it is, isn't it coming for our jobs? Isn't it going to take all of our jobs? And as you can imagine, for everybody who looks at this, that also is split. No, just like every other technical or industrial revolution, it's going to actually end up creating more jobs than we're going to lose. And even if we do lose jobs, it's going to create so much productivity. 2, 3, I just read an article on this. There are a bunch of books coming out. The exponential increase in productivity because of machine learning and AI productivity means if you want a job, you can have one. But for those of you who are retired, your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they can do whatever they want. It's like the Marxist utopia brought about by the most ruthless capital market ever. It's a wonderful historical irony. It's like just great. Why? Why is it going to be so? Why are we going to be awash in money? Because this stuff can do things so quickly, right? And so efficiently. And while it takes a fair bit of energy, it doesn't necessarily take a whole lot of food, time off, all the kinds of things that humans are subject to. Which, in a roundabout way, brings me to the immigration, which is one of the instrumental arguments for immigration is we need the labor, right? There's a tremendous need for, I mean, AI and robotics, automation, it's incredible, but it ain't out there in the field. Well, actually, it is starting to be out there in the field. Well, it's not, yes, it is in the grocery store. Well, it didn't last. They haven't figured this out yet, and you've got to get over the creepy factor. But the last time we were in New York, we were in, I think it was one of the Amazon stores, where there are about 40 billion cameras. There are no, anybody been in one of these? There are no people. You just go in and you think, I want this. And the camera goes click, right? And then you put it back and the camera somehow reads that, or the 40 billion cameras read. And the whole thing is automated. There's just no people anywhere. And it's all possible. You don't need labor, right? The whole point is to get rid of labor to as much a degree as possible. So the instrumental argument for immigration is still there. We still need the labor right now. Whether we will, given what AI and automatics or automation is coming up with, is an open question. But that's not the part of immigration I want to talk about. The debate's Tuesday night, I'm sure it'll come up. The commercials, nothing but immigration. And we talked about it this morning. We talked about it all the time. Everybody wants to talk about it. What's at issue in immigration? New book on this. Nice job, kind of back and forth between somebody who's a staunch proponent, somebody who's pretty much an absolutist in terms of open borders. Okay, open border or quasi-open border policy. Argument number one. Be careful to check yourselves on this one. If you identify as any kind of good liberal slash progressive coming out of traditional 18th, 19th, early 20th century liberalism, in which you believe in, whether you know it or not, moral universalism. Right? It's there in Immanuel Kant and certainly all of his followers, and then in rights development as well. Every human being on the planet is deserving of equal, affirmative, respectful treatment insofar as that person is a person. Don't have to make any more argument or qualifications than that. They feel, they think, they want, they desire, they have rational goals. It's a whole range of things. And on that basis, we should grant them, to the extent possible, the opportunity to realize their full personhood. Well, where can you do that best? Well, for the most part, developed countries. And so those countries like us who adhere to a kind of moral liberalism, a universalism, we've got no real standing for turning anybody away. And furthermore, the borders are themselves arbitrary for the most part. If you know your history, they're being drawn and redrawn all the time, especially in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. And more than that, also if you're a good moral, progressive, liberal, universalist, we have the means to redistribute the goods that we've got so that, if not everybody, at least a much higher percentage of people in the world than can now would be able to live a minimally decent life. Peter Singer and lots of others argue this particular point. So a lot of espoused values, right, amongst, I'll just use myself, moral universalism, yeah, sure, we should distribute the wealth. Those are all good arguments in favor of, if not open, more open borders than we've got. We can afford it, and we've got a moral obligation to be able to afford it and redistribute. Not everybody's thrilled with that argument. And if you saw my house, you would say, this guy does not believe in that at all. He's keeping it all to himself. All right. So those are some of the arguments for. Why not open the borders? Well, we were talking about this morning, and it is, I think, a salient point, though it, I think, discomforts some of us who do think of ourselves maybe as taking a more universalist moral stance. And that is this. There actually is something to the notion of solidarity and historical narrative around our people. Now, before you throw me out, all right, while we nonetheless espouse greater inclusiveness, and one of the ways to read history, even in this country, is, yeah, we actually have, you know, concentric circles of greater inclusiveness, and we've enshrined it in law. I'll use the example that Sandel uses in his, again, rare but amazing book, a bestseller in philosophy, his book on justice, in which he talks about the 1980 airlift by the Israelis of Ethiopian Jews. And he poses the question this way. He says, look, so there's a famine in Ethiopia. There's a lot of refugee camps, people moving into Sudan. There's a lot of conflict. I mean, it's just a lousy situation. Among those hundreds of thousands of Ethiopian refugees are many, many Ethiopian Jews. And the Israelis say, those are our brothers and sisters. Those are the words the prime minister used at the time. We got to go get them and do everything we can. And Sandel says, why? Why are the Israelis specifically targeting, singling out the Ethiopian Jews? Well, the answer is in exactly the phrasing he used. If evolutionarily, whether you love it or not, you know, we are designed family first, kin, we'll take the, you know, try to get our genes in the next generation, whether it's very specifically us or the people very closest, you know, who are closest to us, or then that close circle of family and friends, the people we have the greatest reciprocal altruism with, and then the folks we identify with through culture. And this is a point that Vic was trying to make in the pre-talk that I think is, now I've implicated him, and he'll have to answer to all this as well as me, but this is Sandel. I'll put it on Sandel, not on you. He said, look, you know, despite whatever misgivings you might have about it, said, look at what we actually do. Espouse whatever you want, but look at what we do. Said, there is a narrative around being an American, and then communities within America that make sense to you culturally, and they have bedrock values, whether it's freedom, tolerance, openness to experience, priority in education, certain way you look. In other words, a certain number of norms, social mores, and historical narrative, what the anthropologists call this thick, a thick narrative. I come out of some place. I come out of some people. I am who I am because of that. And that means more to me than just the world at large. And let the world at large take care of itself, you know? People are in severely desperate need. Well, you know, maybe we've got some resources we can help them with, but for the most part, we are our own. I've got special obligations to my people. The Israelis take care of the Jews. Why? Because there's a long history of what it means to be Jewish that means more to them, quite frankly, than what it means to be anything else. You know, it's very nice of the French to let Mandy and I go to France once or twice or three times a year. We never go three times a year, sorry. We would love to go three times a year. But we'd love to go, you know, once a year. But they don't let us vote, right? They don't care what we think about France, really, all that much. And if we wanted to become French, it would be a hell of a long, arduous process legally, and beyond that, culturally, probably impossible, right? At least at this age. Now, if I wanted to go back to the Netherlands, right of return, you know, still, I'd have to really get the language back, jump through a whole bunch of citizenship tests. It's still not clear to me that I would ever really, truly be Dutch. You know, I'm an American. That means certain things. It means certain things about holding to certain kinds of constitutionally inscribed values, certain goals, and a certain history that I'm implicated in. I might have certain advantages from coming from a Dutch background. I might have certain privileges coming from that, source of pride, as well as, you know, a certain amount of shame around colonialism. But that's one of the other ways that he asks us to think about your particular loyalties and your commitments and who you owe what. And that is this. He said, the Vietnam War was a source of shame for many, many Americans, not over the veterans, but over American policy. We're ashamed of our country and the way it prosecuted that war and that they were there at all. A Dutchman, a Swede, a Finn, it's like they can condemn the war, but there's no point in them feeling shame about it, right? There's no shame. It's not theirs. It's ours. And in the same way, everybody, both communities and nation states, have this sense of what they have pride in, what they want to carry on as a legacy, what's important to them. Those are their people. It's not that that can't be expanded. It's not that we can't find. We are peculiar and particular as Americans in our ability to bring in and assimilate people. But we do look for assimilation historically. We look for people to share the same values over time. It's one of the great debates right now. It's like, well, come in and, you know, just stay the same exactly. No, that's not who we're looking for. And the pressure is pretty overwhelming not to do that. Let me close with an anecdote from a study that we're doing right now that I think illustrates this point. It's quite fascinating to me. So we did a piece on, we've been doing pieces on social capital in Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids is unique. There are only a few other cities around its size in the country that have anything close to the kind of social capital, all these informal networks that people help one another without any expectation of necessarily repayment. I mean, it's kind of amazing. It's one of the things that makes the city as successful as it is. And so we're working right now in the Granville Corridor. We're finishing up a study there. Granville Corridor, it's a relatively small part of Grand Rapids. It was historically Dutch. They immigrated there, built a lot of the housing stock, moved out for the most part, became a larger Black community for a while, but for the last 80, 90 years, it's been mostly Hispanic, and right now it's about 70% Hispanic. So we've been meeting with groups of the Hispanic community in the corridor. Do they have bonding social capital? In other words, within the Granville Corridor, how much do they help one another out? And what's their bridging social capital? How able are they to pursue opportunities outside of the corridor by establishing relationships with the powerful institutions in town? And the older folks that we've met with, we're just happy to be here, hunker down, you know, stick to your own guns. I mean, it's really, in some ways, the whole thing follows a very traditional immigrant story that is quite affirming. And then the middle-aged folks, we need some help, we want to do more bridging, and we need more capital, both financial and social, that sort of thing. And then I met with young people, 17 to 24, who were either immigrants brought here by their parents or were born here, first generation. And we had this great conversation that I wish I'd just gone on and on. And, oh, we love the Granville Corridor, and we love our parents, and we love our history and legacy. It's like, okay. And the longer the conversation went on, I said, well, but tell me about looking forward. Tell me, are you going to stay here? Do you have a sense of being Hispanic or Venezuelan or Mexican, or do you have more of a sense of being American? It was a whole series of questions. And finally, near the end, this young woman, they were all A students, they were all going to college. She kind of smiled. She said, you want to know what I really want? I said, yeah, I'd be fascinated. She said, I want to live in East Grand Rapids. And I said, why? And she looked at me like I was an idiot. She said, have you seen the houses in East Grand Rapids? Said, I want a house in East Grand Rapids. I want the safety and security of East Grand Rapids. I want the consuming power of the people who live in East Grand Rapids. I want to know that if we need the police, that they'll come. And she laid out this whole litany of things that, on one hand, sort of like snazzy American stuff. On the other hand, stuff that's, I think, really, really speaks well of us. And so they all kind of smiled and giggled for a while, and they went back and forth, and they said, yeah. I said, yeah, East Grand Rapids. And then one of them spoke up, and this left me feeling actually pretty good about the future of the country. So one of them spoke up, and they said, East Grand Rapids, but, like, with a nice taqueria within walking distance. And I thought, That's it. That's the tension. That's the combination that makes this place especially intriguing. All right. Thanks.